From Intelligix, this is Intelligix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. There is a moment investigators still talk about years later, when everything they thought they knew about a quiet San Diego neighborhood shifted on its axis. It was the autumn of 1984, and a deputy with the San Diego County Sheriff's Department was standing at the edge of a remote canyon, looking down at what the brush and the shadows had been keeping secret. Three members of a single family, a mother, a father, a child, lay there together, as if the canyon itself had swallowed them whole. The deputy would later say he had never seen anything like it. He would not be the last person to say so. To understand what happened in San Diego County across those terrible middle years of the 1980s, you have to begin not with the darkness, but with the light, with the people who lived there before the darkness found them. Susan Knott was, by all accounts, the kind of woman who made a room warmer simply by walking into it. She and her husband, Gary, had built what those who knew them described as an ordinary, lovely life in the hills of San Diego County, the kind of life that looks unremarkable from the outside because it has been constructed, carefully and with love, from all the right materials. Gary worked hard. Susan kept the family anchored. Their daughter, Alicia, was 11 years old, at that age where the world is still mostly a place of wonder and possibility. Friends recalled the Knotts as a close family, the kind who showed up for each other and for the people around them. There was nothing about their story, up until the moment it intersected with a very different kind of story, that would have suggested any of what was coming. They were reported missing in October of 1984. People who loved them made phone calls. Those phone calls became official reports, and those reports eventually led investigators into a canyon, where the Knott family was found, Gary, Susan, and Alicia, their lives taken in an act of sudden, catastrophic violence. The cause of death, as the medical examiner would document, was throat-slashing injuries consistent across all three victims. There were no signs that the family had provoked any confrontation, no obvious motive of the conventional kind. What law enforcement faced in those first days was a scene of profound brutality visited upon people who, by every measure, had simply been going about the business of being alive. The investigation that followed would prove to be one of the most complex and far-reaching in San Diego County history, a case that would stretch across years, cross-reference multiple crime scenes, and ultimately require detectives to look beyond the Knott family to understand what had actually happened to them. Because the Knotts were not the only victims. As investigators began working the case through 1984 and into 1985, a pattern emerged that detectives found deeply troubling. The method, the particular, deliberate nature of the violence, appeared linked to other cases in the county. Two additional victims, killed in a similar manner, surfaced in the investigative record. Each case shared structural similarities with the Knott murders. The victims had been attacked without apparent robbery as a primary motive. The injuries were consistent in nature, and the locations, while scattered across the county's geography, suggested a perpetrator comfortable moving through San Diego's varied terrain. Detectives from multiple jurisdictions began to coordinate. They were looking, they came to believe, for a single person responsible for multiple killings. The San Diego County Sheriff's Department and the District Attorney's Office assembled a task force. They were methodical and, by necessity, patient. This was the mid-1980s, before many of the forensic tools that investigators now take for granted, and the work was painstaking. Interviews, physical evidence collection, the slow triangulation of witness accounts against known timelines. Detectives canvassed. They went back to friends and family members of each victim, asking the same questions from different angles, looking for the thread that would tie the cases together and, more importantly, lead them to a name. That name, when it finally emerged, was not the name of a man who looked, from the outside, like a killer. David Allen Lucas was a contractor. He was, by all available accounts, a man with a family of his own, a working life, the trappings of normalcy. He lived in San Diego County, moved through its communities, bid on jobs, had neighbors. The image he projected to the world around him was, by design or by accident, entirely ordinary. When investigators began to look at him seriously as a suspect in the Knott murders and the related killings, some of the people who knew him struggled, in the way people always struggle, to reconcile the person they thought they knew with the allegations being assembled against him. Investigators linked Lucas to the crimes through a combination of physical evidence and witness testimony. According to court records and contemporaneous reporting on the case, the physical evidence, gathered from crime scenes and processed through the forensic methods available at the time, was painstaking work. Fiber analysis, soil comparisons, the reconstruction of timelines based on material gathered at scenes. Witness testimony also played a role, with individuals placing Lucas in proximity to relevant locations and circumstances during the periods in question. Prosecutors, as they built their case, argued that the totality of the evidence, no single piece in isolation, but the constellation of details taken together, pointed conclusively to Lucas as the person responsible for the deaths of the Knott family and the two other victims. Lucas was arrested and charged. The charges, when they were formally filed, were multiple counts of first-degree murder. The weight of what was alleged against him was enormous, not just in the legal sense, but in the human one. A mother, a father, a child, and two more people besides. Five lives taken, the prosecution would argue, by one man moving through one county in the middle of an otherwise unremarkable decade. Lucas maintained his position through the period leading up to trial. His defense attorneys, as is their obligation and their right, challenged the state's evidence and the conclusions investigators had drawn from it. They questioned the reliability of witness accounts, probed the physical evidence for alternative interpretations, and sought to create, in the minds of jurors, reasonable doubt about whether the man sitting before them in the courtroom was actually the man responsible for what had happened in those canyons and remote stretches of San Diego County. The trial was, by any measure, a significant proceeding. The evidence presented spanned years of investigative work. Prosecutors called witnesses, introduced physical evidence, and constructed a narrative that they argued was supported at every point by documented fact. Defense attorneys countered at every stage. The jury, seated in San Diego County, had the task that juries always have in such circumstances, to weigh everything they were shown and heard, to apply the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and to render a judgment. They did so in 1989. David Allen Lucas was found guilty of multiple counts of first-degree murder. The jury found that the evidence presented by prosecutors, the physical documentation, the witness accounts, the reconstructed timelines, satisfied the burden of proof. The verdict was returned on all counts. And then came the penalty phase, the additional proceeding in which the same jury was asked to determine not whether Lucas had committed the crimes, but what the consequence of that finding should be. The jury sentenced David Allen Lucas to death. The sentence landed in the public record with the particular weight that capital sentences carry. Not the end of the legal story. As every observer of the American criminal justice system understands, but the beginning of a long, slow appellate process that is itself a kind of shadow proceeding running parallel to ordinary time. Death penalty cases in California, then as now, were subject to automatic appeal to the California Supreme Court. Lucas's case entered that process, and the legal arguments that his attorneys had raised at trial, challenges to evidence, to procedure, to the conduct of the investigation, were carried forward into the appellate courts. The California courts reviewed the case across the years that followed. The appeals examined the trial record in detail, considering whether errors had been made that were substantial enough to undermine the integrity of the verdict or the fairness of the proceedings. This is the system working as it is designed to work, not as a rubber stamp, but as a genuine review conducted by judges who examine the record with fresh eyes and apply established legal standards to what they find. The conviction withstood that review. The California Supreme Court, examining the record of the proceedings against David Allen Lucas, upheld the verdict and the sentence. The appeals that followed, through both state and federal courts in the years after that initial review, did not result in the conviction being overturned. Lucas remained on death row at San Quentin State Prison, and as of the last available reporting on his case, his legal status has not changed in its fundamental character. He is a convicted murderer, sentenced to death, whose conviction has survived appellate review. California's death row is, as of this writing, a place of complicated and prolonged legal limbo. The state has maintained a moratorium on executions at various points in its recent history, and the cases of inmates sentenced to death in the 1980s and 1990s have, in many instances, remained unresolved in the practical sense for decades. Lucas's case sits within that broader context. A verdict rendered more than three decades ago, a sentence affirmed by appellate courts, and an execution that has not been carried out. That is not an unusual circumstance for California's death row. It is, rather, the defining characteristic of capital punishment in that state, a legal reality that continues to generate significant debate among lawyers, advocates, policymakers, and the families of victims. It is the families of victims where the human weight of all of this ultimately rests. Gary Knott and Susan Knott and their daughter, Alicia, did not live to see the verdict returned in 1989. The two other victims killed in what prosecutors argued was the same series of crimes were similarly beyond reach of whatever comfort a jury's finding might offer. The people who loved them, parents, siblings, friends, the network of human connection that surrounds every life, were left to carry forward without them. Through the years of investigation and the years of trial and the years of appeal that followed, what the verdict gave those people was not resolution in the way that word is sometimes carelessly used. It did not restore what had been taken, did not answer the deepest questions that grief always asks. What it gave them was a finding, rendered by a jury of their fellow citizens, that the person responsible for those deaths had been identified, tried by the rules of evidence, and held accountable according to law. That is not nothing. For families who have watched investigations stall, who have lived for years without answers, the moment when a jury says we believe you, we find it proven, that moment matters, even when it cannot make the wound whole. David Allen Lucas, the contractor from San Diego County who projected normalcy to the world around him, was something other than what he appeared to be. The jury found that to be true, and the courts that reviewed the jury's work found no sufficient reason to disturb that finding. What drove him toward violence? What mechanism in his interior life produced the decisions that led to those canyons and those victims? Those questions belong to the province of psychology and human mystery, and the courts were not asked to answer them. The courts were asked a narrower question. Did he do it? And to that question, the answer returned was yes. There is something particular about the mid-1980s in Southern California. The sun, the sprawl, the sense that the region was a place of perpetual becoming, of new starts and reinvention. San Diego in those years was growing, spreading, filling in the canyons and hillsides with new construction, new communities, new families. The detective who stood at the edge of that canyon in the autumn of 1984 could not have known, in that moment, that the case would take 5 years to reach its verdict, that it would encompass multiple victims and multiple crime scenes, that it would require the kind of sustained, careful investigative work that tests both the patience and the resolve of. It was into that landscape that the Knotts had brought their life, and it was into that landscape that something predatory had moved, hidden in plain sight behind the face of an ordinary working man. Everyone involved, he knew only what the scene in front of him told him, that something terrible had happened here, and that it was now his job, and the job of everyone who would work the case alongside him, to find out why and who, and to stand in some measure of witness for the people who no longer could. That is what investigations are at their core. Witness, the attempt to reconstruct a truth from what was left behind, the physical traces, the testimonies, the documentary record of a crime that someone tried to commit in the shadow of the county's canyons. The jury that heard People v. David Allen Lucas was asked to weigh all of it, and they did. The verdict they returned has endured. Alicia Knott was 11 years old. She had a whole life ahead of her, the kind of life that an 11-year-old cannot yet fully imagine, the friends she would have made, the person she might have become. All of that was foreclosed in an autumn canyon in San Diego County in 1984, and the grief of that foreclosure belongs to people who still carry it, decades on. Their names deserve to be spoken, their lives deserve to be lived, and the care with which the system ultimately assembled the case against the man who took those lives, imperfect and slow and subject to all the complications of law and human fallibility, is the closest thing the law can offer to honoring them. It is sometimes enough, and sometimes it is simply what there is. Our next case takes us to King County / Pacific Highway, Washington. The call came in on a summer morning in 1982 from the banks of the Green River south of Seattle, where the water moves slow and brown through the tall grass. A man had found something in the shallows, something terrible. And when King County detectives arrived and waded in, they understood almost immediately that what they were looking at was not the beginning of something. It was already, by then, well underway. Her name was Deborah Bonner. She was 23 years old. Within days, more bodies surfaced from that same stretch of river, and the name that would haunt the Pacific Northwest for the next two decades was born, the Green River Killer. It would be 19 years before that name had a face. To understand what was lost in those years, you have to understand who these women were. Not the shorthand that lazy journalism sometimes reached for, not the abstractions that let a community look away, but actual women, with people who loved them and futures that were stolen from them before they ever had the chance to unfold. Opal Mills was 16 years old. She liked to draw. Her family said she was funny, quick, and kind in the way that teenagers sometimes are before the world has had a chance to teach them not to be. Cynthia Hines was 17, a young woman whose family remembered her warmth, the way she could fill a room. Terry Milligan had a daughter. Wendy Caulfield was just 16, from Puyallup, and she had already survived more difficulty in her short life than most people see in decades. Many of Gary Ridgway's victims were young women in precarious circumstances, some involved in street-level survival sex work along Pacific Highway South, the long commercial corridor that locals called the Strip, south of SeaTac Airport. Some were runaways. Some were women whose disappearances King County would later acknowledge with the weight of genuine institutional reckoning were not always treated with the urgency that a daughter from a different neighborhood might have received. That acknowledgement came slowly, and it came too late for dozens of families who spent years not knowing, or knowing and being unable to prove it, or being told their daughters had simply chosen to leave. That inequity, the gap between who gets looked for and who gets left, would become one of the defining moral questions of the Green River case. And it is a question that American law enforcement has still not fully answered. By the mid-1980s, the task force assigned to the Green River murders had grown to include over 50 detectives, making it one of the largest investigations in Washington state history at that time. The scale of what they were chasing was becoming clearer and more horrifying with each passing season. Bodies were being found not just in the river but across a wide geography, in wooded areas, in clusters, sometimes miles apart. Investigators believed the killer was organized, that he was returning to sites, that he knew this landscape the way a person knows their own neighborhood, because it was. Gary Leon Ridgway was born in 1949 and grew up in the SeaTac area. By the early 1980s, he was working as a truck painter at the Kenworth Truck Factory in Renton, a job he would hold for more than three decades. He was married, intermittently, three marriages over the course of his adult life. Neighbors and co-workers described him as unremarkable, forgettable, the kind of man whose name you would not remember a week after meeting him, which, prosecutors would later argue, was something he understood and used. He came to the task force's attention early. In 1983, a sex worker named Marie Malvar was last seen getting into a pickup truck. Her boyfriend, who witnessed it, later identified Ridgway as the driver when he spotted the same truck. Detectives interviewed Ridgway that year. He denied everything, and there was not enough to hold him. In 1984, investigators searched his home and his truck. They found nothing that rose to the level of probable cause for an arrest. In 1987, in a move that seemed promising, they obtained a saliva sample from Ridgway for DNA comparison. But the technology of the era was not yet refined enough to produce a definitive match to the evidence they had from victim scenes. And so Gary Ridgway went home. He went back to work. He went to church. Co-workers would say later that he sometimes read the Bible at lunch. He continued, prosecutors allege and the record confirms, to kill. The task force worked through the late 1980s and into the 1990s. Tips numbered in the tens of thousands. The investigation consumed enormous resources and generated an immense volume of data. Sheriff's detectives worked alongside the FBI. Criminal profiler John Douglas, who helped develop the modern science of behavioral analysis, was consulted. Various suspects were considered and eliminated. The case became, in true crime circles and in the regional consciousness of the Pacific Northwest, something almost mythological, the killer who could not be caught, the crimes that would never be solved. Families of victims lived in that limbo for years. Some of them never stopped pushing. They attended press conferences and wrote letters and demanded that their daughters not be forgotten, that the investigation not be quietly shelved. In 1986, relatives of the victims held a candlelight vigil. They kept holding them. They kept showing up. The turning point, when it finally came, arrived in the form of science that simply had not existed when the investigation began. By the late 1990s, forensic DNA analysis had advanced to a degree that allowed laboratories to produce genetic profiles from biological evidence that older techniques could not have processed. The King County Sheriff's Office, working with a cold case unit, submitted evidence from four of the original Green River victims for retesting using short tandem repeat analysis, a far more precise methodology than what had been available in 1987. The samples had been preserved. They had been waiting. In 2001, the Washington State Patrol Crime Laboratory produced results that, according to court documents, linked DNA recovered from multiple victims to the saliva sample collected from Gary Leon Ridgway 14 years earlier. The match, prosecutors stated, was definitive. On November 30, 2001, 19 years after Deborah Bonner was found in the Green River, King County detectives arrested Gary Ridgway in the parking lot of the Kenworth truck plant where he had worked for over 30 years. He was 52 years old. He did not resist. What followed was one of the most consequential and, in many ways, most agonizing legal negotiations in the history of American criminal justice. Prosecutors faced a stark reality. DNA evidence had conclusively linked Ridgway to at least four victims, but investigators believed, and Ridgway had begun to indicate, through his attorneys, that the true number of victims was far larger. Families of dozens of women whose fates remained unknown needed answers. They needed to know where their daughters were, where their sisters were, whether there were remains still lying somewhere in the landscape south of Seattle that had never been recovered. That knowledge lived, exclusively and completely, inside Gary Ridgway's memory. King County prosecutor Norm Malung made a decision that he acknowledged publicly was not an easy one, and which he knew many people would never fully accept. in exchange for Ridgway's full cooperation. His agreement to lead investigators to undiscovered remains, to provide detailed information about each victim, to spend years in interviews helping investigators identify and locate the women he had killed. The death penalty would be taken off the table. Ridgway would plead guilty to 49 counts of aggravated first-degree murder and spend the rest of his natural life in prison without the possibility of parole. Prosecutor Malink said at the time that he made the decision because he believed that giving some families the ability to bury their daughters was worth more than an execution. Not every family agreed. That is the honest truth of it, and it deserves to be said plainly. Some victims' families were devastated by the agreement. They felt that Ridgway had been handed a gift, that the state of Washington had handed a man who had committed an almost incomprehensible number of murders the thing he most wanted, which was to remain alive and in control. They said so, publicly and with a grief that no careful legal calculus can fully address. Their anger was legitimate. It remains legitimate. Other families said that finally knowing, finally having a location, finally having remains to bring home and bury, was something they had prayed for, and that they were grateful for that, even if grateful was a word that tasted wrong in their mouths. Both of those things were true at once. That is part of what makes the Green River case so morally complicated, so resistant to any clean resolution. On November 5, 2003, Gary Leon Ridgway appeared in King County Superior Court. He was calm, almost mechanical. He entered guilty pleas to 49 counts of aggravated first-degree murder, the largest number of such counts ever entered in United States history at that time. Judge Richard Jones accepted the plea. As part of the agreement, Ridgway Reed prepared statements acknowledging each killing, and for a courtroom full of family members who had waited years and years for any kind of accounting, the experience was by turns devastating, and for some, something closer to necessary. Several family members were permitted to address Ridgway directly at sentencing. They told him what he had taken from them, in language that was clear and furious and heartbroken. Robert Rule, whose daughter Linda had been one of Ridgway's victims, stood and told Ridgway that he forgave him, not because what Ridgway had done was forgivable, but because Rule had decided that hatred was a weight he was unwilling to carry. That statement was not made on behalf of other families, and it was not meant to be. It was one man's choice about how to survive. Ridgway, for his part, made statements that investigators and psychologists found consistent with the profile of a killer who had thought about his crimes in deeply utilitarian terms. He spoke about victims in ways that revealed an almost total absence of the emotional architecture that most humans use to process other people as people. Investigators who had spent years interviewing him described the experience as profoundly unsettling, not because he was dramatic or menacing, but because he was so ordinary, so flat, so entirely without the quality that might have made his crimes feel explicable. Judge Jones sentenced Ridgway to life in prison without the possibility of parole for each of the 49 counts, the sentences to run consecutively. There would be no appeals of the conviction. The guilty plea foreclosed that avenue, and the sentence has remained undisturbed. Ridgway is currently incarcerated at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, where he remains to this day. The cooperation agreement produced results, though incomplete ones. Over the years following his arrest, Ridgway led investigators to additional remains and provided information that helped identify victims whose fates had been unknown. Several sets of remains were recovered that might otherwise never have been found. Families were notified. Some burials, long overdue, finally took place. He also claimed, in interviews with investigators, that his actual victim count was higher than 49, possibly as many as 71, he said, though he expressed uncertainty about the precise number in a way that was itself disturbing, as though the individual lives had blurred together in his memory. Not all of those potential additional victims have been definitively linked to him. Some cases remain open. some families still do not have answers. The Green River Task Force was formally disbanded after the conviction, but King County investigators have continued to work on associated cold cases over the years since. The official confirmed victim count as of the conviction stands at 49. What do you do with something like this? How do you hold it? The honest answer is that you hold it imperfectly, because that is all anyone can do. The Green River case challenges almost every framework we have for thinking about criminal justice, about whether punishment serves victims, about whether information can be worth the price of an execution, about who gets protected and who gets left to navigate dangerous roads alone. It raises questions about the failures of systems that were supposed to safeguard vulnerable people and did not. It raises questions about a killer who looked so entirely ordinary that his coworkers, his neighbors, his wives did not see him, and whether that ordinariness should disturb us more than a more dramatic monster would. The women who were killed, Deborah Bonner and Opal Mills and Cynthia Hines and Wendy Caulfield and Terry Milligan and dozens more, each one of them a complete human life with texture and history, and people who loved them, deserve to be remembered as individuals, not as a number, however large that number is. 49 is an almost incomprehensible count, and the danger of numbers that large is that they collapse into abstraction, and the abstraction is easier to look at than the faces. There were 49 faces. There were 49 lives before the Strip, before Pacific Highway South, before Gary Ridgway. Families spent years, some of them decades, not knowing what had happened to the people they loved. Some of those families got answers. Some did not. The river still moves south of Seattle, slow and brown through the tall grass. The highway still runs alongside it. And somewhere in that landscape, if you know where to look, there are places that hold a history that no conviction, no sentence, no legal resolution can fully contain. The questions that the Green River case asks us have not been answered. They are waiting, the way evidence sometimes waits, for something sharp enough to finally read them clearly. Our next case takes us to Anniston, Alabama. There is a moment, preserved in the clinical language of a 1979 medical chart from Anniston's Northeast Alabama Regional Medical Center, that captures something almost impossible to comprehend. A young woman named Carol Hilly lay in a hospital bed, her body failing in ways that baffled the physicians attending her. Her hands and feet had gone numb. Her hair was falling out. She was losing weight at a rate that defied any ordinary explanation, and the doctors who examined her rotated through diagnoses the way a person flips through channels, looking for something that makes sense. Meanwhile, her mother sat at her bedside, attentive, devoted, worried by all appearances, in the way that only a mother can be worried. What no one in that hospital understood yet, what would take years and a fugitive chase across several states to fully unravel, was that the woman pulling her chair closer to that bed was the reason her daughter was dying. Her name was Audrey Marie Hilly, and for a long time in Anniston, Alabama, she was the kind of woman people trusted instinctively. She was born Audrey Marie Frazier in 1931 in Anniston, and by all accounts she grew into someone who understood, with unusual precision, how to present herself. She was organized, sociable, the sort of neighbor who brought food when there was a death in the family and remembered the names of your children. She married Frank Hilly in 1951, a quiet, steady man who worked for a local pipe manufacturing company, and together they built what looked, from the outside, like an ordinary and respectable life. They had two children, Michael and Carol. They lived in a modest house. Frank was not a dramatic man, not a man who drew attention, and neither, in those years, was Audrey. She was simply part of the fabric of the community, stitched in so thoroughly that, when things began to go wrong, it took a very long time for anyone to pull at the loose threads. Frank Hilly had not been a well man. He'd suffered from various health complaints over the years, and so in the spring of 1975, when he became severely ill, nauseated, weak, his body staging a kind of internal revolt, The people around him, including his doctors, had a framework into which this new illness could be made to fit. He was hospitalized. He deteriorated. On May 25, 1975, Frank Hilly died at the age of 45. The cause of death was listed as infectious hepatitis. He was buried and Audrey collected on his life insurance policy, and life in that particular grinding way that it does after loss went on. But not really. Not underneath. In the years after Frank's death, Audrey Hilly accumulated debt with a kind of reckless efficiency. She wrote bad checks. She borrowed money she did not repay. She took out insurance policies on herself, on her children, and the particulars of those policies would later draw the careful attention of investigators. She was, by the late 1970s, in serious financial trouble, and the pressure of that trouble was something she kept carefully hidden behind the same composed, capable exterior she had always maintained. And then Carol got sick. Carol Hilly was in her early 20s when her health began to collapse. It happened gradually, the way the worst things often do, a little weakness here, some nausea there, symptoms that individually might mean almost anything and collectively painted a picture that no one could quite read. She lost sensation in her extremities. She lost weight. Her hair thinned. She was hospitalized repeatedly, and each time her mother was there, present and concerned, offering to help with her care, sometimes even administering treatments or preparing food that she brought from home. The doctors remained puzzled. In the language of medicine, Carol Hilly was a diagnostic mystery. It was not until 1979, when a physician named Dr. Donald Corder grew sufficiently alarmed by the constellation of Carol's symptoms to order a specific and telling test, that the mystery began to resolve into something far more sinister. The test revealed arsenic in Carol's system, arsenic at levels that had no innocent explanation. Arsenic, which in sufficient doses produces exactly the symptoms Carol had been experiencing. The peripheral neuropathy, the hair loss, the gastrointestinal devastation. Arsenic, which is tasteless and colorless and dissolves readily in liquid. Arsenic, which had been used as a poison for so long and so effectively that it was once called inheritance powder by the Italians of the Renaissance, because of the convenient deaths it produced in wealthy relatives. The discovery at the hospital triggered a call to law enforcement, and law enforcement, once they began looking, found that they had more questions than they had first imagined. Frank Hilly's death, 4 years earlier, had been attributed to hepatitis, but arsenic poisoning, in its acute phases, can mimic the symptoms of hepatitis with terrible fidelity. The Calhoun County authorities moved to exhume Frank Hilly's body, and the subsequent forensic analysis, according to court records and contemporaneous reporting, found arsenic in his remains as well, at levels consistent with poisoning. Suddenly, Audrey Hilly was not a grieving widow and a devoted mother. She was a suspect. She was arrested in 1979 on charges related to the poisoning of Carol and fraud connected to the bad checks she had been writing. Carol, removed from her mother's care, began to recover. It was slow and it was difficult, but she recovered. Her body, it turned out, had simply needed to be removed from the source of its contamination. That recovery, while Carol's own and hard won, would also become a crucial piece of evidence in the case that prosecutors were building. But before that case could be fully made, Audrey Hilly did something that would transform a local criminal matter into a story that captured national attention. She ran. In January of 1980, while out on bail, Audrey Marie Hilly simply disappeared. She had been charged with the attempted murder of her daughter, and was facing a more serious investigation into her husband's death, and rather than face what was coming, she walked away from Anniston and became someone else. She was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, one of the very few women ever to achieve that distinction, and for nearly 3 years she remained at large, moving through several states and constructing identities with a facility that investigators would later find remarkable. She eventually landed in Marlow, New Hampshire, presenting herself as a woman named Robbie Hannon. She found work, found a community, found a man named John Hammond, whom she eventually married. By all accounts, her neighbors in New Hampshire found her pleasant and believable. She had, apparently, the same gift for presentation that had served her in Anniston. But sustaining a false identity over years requires continuous effort. And at some point, Audrey Hilly appears to have concluded that the identity of Robbie Hannon had run its course. What she did next is one of the more audacious elements of an already extraordinary story. Robbie Hannon became ill, critically ill, according to her account, and informed her husband and her community that she was dying. She did, in fact, disappear, and the story was put forth that Robbie Hannon had died. But then, shortly thereafter, a woman appeared and introduced herself as Robbie's twin sister, Terry Martin. Terry Martin, this new woman explained, had come to comfort John Hammond in his grief. She moved in with him. She continued, in other words, to live with the same man in the same community while pretending to be a completely different person, her own fictional twin. It was this improbable construction that finally unraveled her. In November of 1982, a tip from someone in Marlow who had grown suspicious of the situation reached law enforcement, and when investigators looked more carefully at Terry Martin, they found Audrey Marie Hilly. She was arrested in Remlap, Alabama, where she had apparently traveled to visit her son Michael. The fugitive who had been running for nearly 3 years was now in custody, and the full weight of what prosecutors had been building since 1979 could finally be brought to bear. The trial that followed, in 1983, in Calhoun County Circuit Court, was a meticulously documented proceeding. Prosecutors argued that Audrey Hilly had poisoned her husband Frank over a period of time in 1975, and that she had later systematically poisoned her daughter Carol between roughly 1978 and 1979. They presented the forensic evidence from Frank's exhumed remains, testimony from the physicians and toxicologists who had analyzed Carol's condition and identified the arsenic in her system, and evidence related to the insurance policies that stood to benefit Audrey upon Frank's death. They argued a portrait of deliberate, calculated conduct, a woman who had used arsenic not in a single impulsive moment, but repeatedly, over time, in a manner that required sustained intent. Carol Hilly herself was among those who testified. Whatever one might say about the emotional weight of that moment, a daughter testifying about what her mother had done to her, the record is plain that her testimony was part of the evidence the jury considered. The defense, for its part, challenged the forensic conclusions and presented what arguments it could on behalf of a woman who faced serious evidentiary headwinds. But the jury was not persuaded by the defense's case. On June 9, 1983, the jury found Audrey Marie Hilly guilty of the murder of Frank Hilly and guilty of the attempted murder of Carol Hilly. The judge sentenced her to life in prison for the murder conviction and an additional 20 years for the attempted murder, sentences to be served consecutively. It was, in the language of the law, a resolution. The case that had begun with a puzzling death in 1975 and had sprawled across years and state lines and assumed identities had arrived at a verdict. Hilly appealed her conviction. The Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals reviewed the case and affirmed the convictions, as did the Alabama Supreme Court. The legal challenges she mounted did not succeed in disturbing the jury's findings, and she remained incarcerated at Wetumpka's Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women. She would not serve her full sentence. On February 26, 1987, Audrey Marie Hilly was granted a weekend pass, a furlough from the prison, part of a program designed to ease the transition for certain inmates. She did not return when she was supposed to. She had once again decided to run. But this time, it did not go the way it had before. Within days, she was found outside a home in Anniston, in the cold, in a state of exposure and deterioration that suggested she had been wandering for some time. She was taken to a hospital, and on February 28, 1987, Audrey Marie Hilly died. She was 55 years old. The causes were attributed to exposure and heart failure. She died, as she had lived in those final years, outside the bounds of the life she had been assigned, trying to be somewhere other than where she was. What lingers, when you sit with this case at the distance of decades, is not the details of the poison, though those details are precise and damning, but the human wreckage left in its wake. Frank Hilly died believing, presumably, that his body had simply failed him, that he was a victim of ordinary illness. He never had the chance to know differently, which may be its own particular cruelty or its own particular mercy, depending on how you look at it. And Carol Hilly, who as a young woman lay in a hospital bed losing her hair and the feeling in her hands, while the woman who had given her life sat nearby, Carol survived. She rebuilt. The record reflects that she did not let what was done to her define the entirety of who she became, which is a kind of courage that the trial transcript cannot fully capture. The neighbors in Anniston, the community in New Hampshire, investigators and forensic specialists who have studied the Hilly case in the years since her death have noted that her methods, the gradual administration of arsenic, the mimicking of natural illness, the careful maintenance of a concerned and devoted persona, reflect a pattern that is not unique to her, but that remains among the most difficult for law enforcement to. The husband who thought he had fallen in love with a woman named Robbie Hannon and then mourned her death while she sat next to him under a different name. The concentric circles of people touched by Audrey Hilly's choices are wide, and the damage that radiates from a sustained deception of this kind is not easily measured. Detect and prosecute. It is the invisibility of it, the way it hides inside the ordinary gestures of care, that makes it so terrible. The hand that brings the soup, the voice that speaks with the nurses, the face arranged in worry, justice in this case came. It came slowly, and it required forensic science and an exhumation and a fugitive manhunt and the testimony of a daughter who had every reason to prefer that none of it had ever happened. But it came. The jury in Calhoun County looked at the evidence and returned a verdict that the appellate court sustained, and the legal record of this case stands as a documented accounting of what Audrey Marie Hilly did and what the state of Alabama determined her conduct deserved. Frank Hilly deserved better than what he got. Carol Hilly deserved a mother. And the quiet town of Anniston, Alabama, deserved not to have been the starting place for all of it. Those are not legal findings. They are simply true. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intelligix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.